In this episode of Nightmare Echoes, Elazar and Jesse cover the 2018 horror film Hereditary, starring Toni Collette, Millie Shapiro, Gabriel Byrnes, and Alex Wolff. This is one film that you need to see before I root it for you. I didn't know what to expect going into it, and it was actually recommended by someone at work, and I absolutely loved it. Also, spoiler warnings for Cube and the Insidious franchise. I also want to mention that some other movies we're covering next in the next coming weeks are Friday the 13th, Jennifer's Body, Insidious, and The Craft, so please subscribe if you don't want to miss any of those. If you'd like to follow us on Instagram, we're at Nightmare Echoes Pod. And if you'd like to email us, we're at nightmareechoespod@gmail.com. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to Nightmare Echoes. I'm your host, Elazar, and I'm joined by co-host Jesse. Jesse, how's it going?
Pretty great. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, you're welcome. Today we're talking about Hereditary. It came out in 2018. It was written and directed by Ari Aster, who also did Midsommar. It stars Toni Collette as Annie, who I remember as the mom from The Sixth Sense. Millie Shapiro as Charlie. Gabriel Byrnes as Steve. I know him from Usual Suspects, End of Days, and Stigmata. And Alex Wolff as Peter, who I know from M. Night Shyamalan's Old. It had a budget of $10 million, and it made $82.8 million in the box office. So before we start, did you want to give a spoiler-free summary?
Yeah. So we have a movie that is about a family that has lost someone, and all the members of the family are dealing with it in their own way, and there starts to be hints of something to do with a séance, and is there a family history of some ability to be a medium or something like that? Well, it's kind of mysterious. There is another disaster. Something else goes wrong, and more things keep going wrong, and maybe more has been inherited than the ability to be a medium. And the way that it goes in some surprising directions, and by the end, it turns out that this movie was about something very different than you thought it was.
Sure. Yeah, I did not know what to expect the first time I watched it. I like being able to analyze it and like following step by step, seeing what happened when. I think it was a lot of fun. So we're going to get into it. If you haven't seen it, I would suggest going to watch it. It's really good to watch it unspoiled. So I think there's some shocking moments in it that you're like, what the heck? And I wouldn't want you to have that ruined if you didn't see it. So pause it if you haven't seen it. Go see it, please. Come back and listen. But here we go. We're going to start. The movie opens. We have an obituary for Ellen Taper. Ellen Taper Light. She was 78 years old and she died on April 3rd, 2018. We really get in this like first kind of scene where we're meeting the family. We start with seeing these amazing miniatures that are main character Annie, maybe the main character. I guess it could be her or Peter.
Yeah, she's the mother of the family and the daughter of the person who just died. So the person who just died is like the grandmother of the family.
Right, and she is a miniaturist. She makes a lot of
dioramas, yeah.
Yeah, for her job, but she also does it as a hobby as well because she's made her own house into a miniature. And so when we zoom in on one of the rooms, it's hard to tell when it stopped being a miniature and started being real footage.
Oh, they did some really cool camera stuff there.
That was amazing.
Yeah, that was well done.
And we zoom into Peter's room and Peter's sleeping, and Steve, the dad, walks in to wake him up, says that their mother's already in the car waiting to go to the funeral, and he needs to get dressed and go. And then she's looking for his daughter, Charlie, and he has to go over to the treehouse and find Charlie. And we see when he walks over the treehouse that Annie's shirt is already waiting in the car.
And man, they created such an ominous atmosphere in this movie. And like the way they're first showing all this, when they show the treehouse, it's like you're scared of the treehouse before you have any idea why.
Sure.
You know, like it's amazing how they did that.
Yeah, I like it. They used the heaters to make the treehouse glow red.
That's awesome.
Which gave an eerie effect. Yeah, there's parts of the movie where characters are looking at it and you see the glowing red in their eyes, which I think is so well done because the room that they're in and them are kind of tinted blue because it's nighttime and the only red in the picture is the reflection in their eyes when they're looking at that treehouse.
Nice.
I think it's really good. At the funeral, there's a lot more people in attendance than Annie would have expected to be there. She talks about her mother. She says her mother had a very private life. She didn't know a lot about her and she probably feels that if her mother were watching this, she would feel betrayed by her sharing information about her mother at the funeral. We have people paying the respects. We see Charlie, who's the little girl, walking up to the casket, and when she does, there's this blonde man that is just creepily smiling at her. I thought it was a little just freaky the way he did this. And then we have a scene where she's in the back of the funeral eating a chocolate bar, and they let us, you know, everybody in the family's like, hey, does that contain nuts? Because we didn't bring the EpiPen.
Implying that the daughter, the girl, I mean, her name is Charlie, right?
Charlie.
Just call her what she has, that Charlie has some horrible nut allergy or whatever.
Right.
But clearly is also irreverent element, I guess, established by the fact that she's eating that chocolate bar, you know, that she doesn't really care what's going on very much, right?
Sure.
That was the vibe I got.
Yeah, I mean, she should be trusted, I guess, to, one, be able to tell if a chocolate bar has nuts in it. I feel like the scene was only there to establish that she has the allergy, but it also puts... I thought so, but it also puts forth that the parents, they're freaking out about it now, but if it was really a concern of theirs, why not bring the EpiPen everywhere you go?
Right.
Like, it should be habitual.
See, and I really thought it was more just establishing that the daughter was, you know, was not very clued in or didn't really care very much about the funeral or grandmother.
Okay, that's
but
true.
I may have misread that. I'm not
she
sure.
She also could have been in shock, you know, kind of like...
Maybe, but she's also a weird character.
She is a weird character.
And you're not sure what to make of her ever throughout right. the movie.
Yeah, we also established really early on that she clucks, like...
Yeah,
she all the time.
Clicks her tongue, and at odd moments that seem it's very off-putting, actually.
It is. It's frustrating. Yeah, I don't know. I heard reports of people doing it in theater.
Yeah,
and that would drive me nuts because you're wait, what? No, at home, Annie doesn't know how she's supposed to feel. We see her making a miniature of a hospice, and Steve comes in to ask her about her work.
It's clear they had a strained relationship. By the way, when she gave the eulogy, it was clear she wasn't sure what to say to, like, it was obvious she didn't have a best relationship with her mother. Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And they go over that a little bit when they get to the support group scene. We get like a big history on that. We establish that Annie has 6.5 months left to finish the two projects she's working on. One of them is a preschool and one of them is a hospice.
Yeah, the little dioramas of I don't know how you make money selling dioramas to art galleries, but okay.
Yeah, I don't know either. I thought maybe like people were going to build construction after she made her models, but that's not how you do it, right? Like you do blueprints.
No, because she was talking to a gallery.
Is that what it was?
She kept talking to a gallery on the phone. So it was like she's an artist and these are art pieces, which just seems odd.
Sure.
But everything about the movie is odd, so I'll allow it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they had enough money already and she just sold them on the side for fun. I don't know if she was a big breadwinner in the family. I know Steve had a job as well.
Yeah, it could be that, yeah, who knows, right?
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure.
And they may have family money.
Yeah, sure. Annie goes to check on Charlie to see how she's doing after the funeral. We establish by looking at her desk that she makes a lot of weird figures from junk that she finds lying around, like old glue bottles and paper clips, and just makes these figures. And Annie tells...
Which is oddly similar to what her mother does. Just want to point that out.
It is. It's just different.
It's like a twisted version of what her mother does.
Yeah.
Like later when we see her cut the head off of a pigeon and use that in one of the...
Yeah.
It's like, it's freaking crazy.
It is a little crazy. Yeah, it's definitely more twisted. It looked fun. It looked like something that if I were to start doing, my wife might get annoyed that... like another hobby. I do have a lot of hobbies. Miniatures are definitely one of them. But then Annie is talking to Charlie, telling Charlie that Charlie's grandmother was her favorite. And then Charlie lets us know that the grandmother wanted her to be a boy, which is a interesting little detail.
Yeah, it is. And it makes a lot of sense later.
Sure, completely. We also see that there's a weird word written on the back of Charlie's bed on the wall.
It's not like an English word either.
No, it's like S-A-T-O-N-Y.
Yeah, Satony, whatever that is.
Right. And it's, I mean, we get a lot of little words. Words written throughout the movie, they're like hidden in bedrooms
on walls
and stuff.
And things like that, and they're just strange, non-English, unrecognizable words. And they don't really tell us what they're about. They just kind of, the camera shows it, and I'm like, okay, I don't know what we're supposed to make of this. And that's a lot of this movie is like showing you things that you don't know what to make of, and just leaving you going, huh.
Annie's looking through some of her mom's old belongings. She has a book on spiritualism, and there's a note inside that ends with "Love, Mommy." As she's leaving the room, she turns the light off, and we think that she sees a shape in the corner. It's hard to tell, like the lighting's really bad.
Yeah,
the music implies that she does see something. It's filmed very creepily, and she finally turns on the light,
and it's gone.
It's nothing. Yeah, there's nothing there. And then she goes out of the way she sees a diorama of her mother, and she spins it around so her mother can't be looking at her.
Yeah,
which is a little weird.
I mean, it's understandable, I think, given everything we know, right? About, and I mean, I've seen people do that in shows too, where it's like,
don't look at me.
Well, like even the old trope of when someone's cheating on their wife, like they turn around the picture of their wife, you know, in the bedroom, like
exactly,
stuff like that. It's kind of the same idea.
Yeah, that makes sense. At school, Charlie is building a figure when they're taking a quiz. And the teacher, I think, was a really cool teacher. She's like, hey, you done with your quiz? And she's like, Charlie's like, not yet. And she goes, okay, well, how about you finish your quiz and then you play with the toy? I thought that was really cool because I think in school, my toy would have been confiscated.
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher was like, you can either get it after school or at the end of the year kind of thing.
This is also a good point to bring up. Like, for most of the movie, I was assuming Charlie was supposed to be somehow mentally handicapped.
Yeah.
But it was never, she didn't talk much, so it was never, I mean, she mostly just clicked, right? So
yeah.
Because of that, it was hard to be sure. And I'm not sure what it was that made me think that. Maybe just the way she, the blank way she reacted in social situations.
Sure.
But, well, as you know, by the end, we know something very different.
Yeah. Well, I feel like some of her grandmother's influence happened because on, you know, I've watched it several times now. I feel like that's something very different happens after the grandma's grave is desecrated based on what we think we know about how, I mean, we'll just, let's just ruin it.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, well, we're going to talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a demon that's been bouncing around the family.
Very intentionally with the recipient's, you know, permission, enthusiastic permission, apparently, because right. They're all crazy cultists.
So we learn at one point that the head, or we have to, I guess, deduce this, that the head of the person holding the demon has to come off for them to be released.
Yeah.
So if that is the case, then Charlie could not be
right.
The demon yet.
Right,
She is the demon after the grandma's body has been stolen.
I hadn't even thought about that. You're right. That makes sense.
I think I didn't think of that until the third viewing, as I was, you know, taking notes of it and really like examining when it happens. Okay.
If that's true, what you said earlier, not on this podcast, but outside of this podcast,
sure.
You had mentioned you thought that the demon might have been signified by the clicking.
Right. I think that's wrong. And I think
it has to be wrong, but then that makes things weirder because there was the clicking later in other people.
Right, right. So, okay, yeah, let's just go to that. That's fine.
Yeah.
I think when Peter clicks towards the end, that, or at the very end of the movie, that everybody up until this point is also sharing that body with Peter. Because Joan, who's the friend of the woman that has died already, like the funeral we had, who pretends to be Annie's friend, calls Peter Charlie and calls Peter Payman and calls Peter Peter.
I didn't never notice that.
At the very end of the movie, she refers to him as every name. She's like, Peter, don't worry. She calls him Charlie as well. And it's like all their essences have moved with Payman into this body. And I think that's why the clucking exists, to show us that Charlie is also in that body with Payman.
Okay, that's a very interesting thought, that he brings all the souls with him. He's got just some big wad of souls that he carries everywhere he goes.
And I thought about it, because if your rewards are supposed to be great for bringing him, because they keep hinting that in the literature that they find in this movie, that you have this great reward. There's no great reward if you have to chop your head off to move him to the next body.
Right, that does make sense.
So if you are included in this, I think so. And then just as we're talking about it, we'll get back to the movie.
I'm sorry, I wanted to say a little bit more. There's a couple of other possible ways to interpret it too. I was thinking you could also interpret it, you know, like the Trill in Star Trek?
Yeah.
Like how freaking all the Daxes carry sort of bits and pieces of the personality of the previous
hosts. Yeah, that's a good analogy, yeah.
Just from, like, that's another possible thing that's a little bit less than bringing the whole soul along, but just like that Payman carries some of their essence just by having been fused with them for a while.
But
you know what I mean?
I do.
And then there's another possibility, which is just that Payman is doing the clucking on purpose just to freak people out, because he's a kind of sadistic, you know, dude and just wants to creep them out. But I do think your theory is very appealing also.
Sure. Well, the one piece of evidence that seems to support the way I look at it now is there's a blue light that goes across the room, I believe, when the Soho has been freed from it.
Yes.
We see that happen when Charlie is looking for her grandmother out in the grassy area. And then we see it later when Peter's at school towards the end, when Joan is trying to expel his spirit from his body. But Peter doesn't get the soul in him then. It's like Payman is roaming free trying to home in on him. But ends up landing in his mother first. And that doesn't happen until Steve is burned alive. We're going all out of order.
Yeah, we are. It happens.
Oh, yeah. No, you're fine. I mean, yeah, we're going to spoil the whole thing anyway. So, all right. So Charlie is taking the quiz. And when the teacher tells her to put away the toy, a bird slams into the window.
Yeah.
And the whole class is like shocked. Has that ever happened to you?
No.
That happened to me in college calculus.
It's interesting because I don't know if that signifies anything. It just seems like a random event to creep you out. Like,
right. Yeah, but for me, since it did happen to me in a math class once in college, I thought it was just like so weird that it
did anyone in your class like cluck or
no, not to
none of them had their heads cut off or anything?
Not that my knowledge.
Okay, that's a good sign.
Right? Yeah. Right.
I'll have to be a little suspicious of you now, though. You understand?
That's naturally. I mean, we do a horror podcast.
That's true. So,
then we cut to Peter's classroom. He's sitting behind this girl named Bridget. He's staring at her butt. It's like very obvious that he's staring at her butt. Peter gets a text message from another boy in class who's just sitting like a row over and one seat behind him, asking if he wants to smoke weed at lunch. And he's so into this text message, I don't know why it takes him so long to read it, but the teacher calls on him and asks him to answer a question. And Peter doesn't know how to respond. He wasn't paying attention. And Bridget stares at him. I don't know. I don't know what was in this look. She's like, come on, dude. Or like, were you not paying attention? I don't know. It was a weird look that she gave him. And then after class, this is where we see Charlie cutting the head off the bird while eating another candy bar.
Yeah.
But she stole the teacher's scissors. Like, we saw her staring at them in the classroom.
I like her style.
Yeah. It's like, I don't care. I'll eat a candy bar. She cuts the head off the bird and she looks across the street and everywhere.
To be clear, it's a dead bird. Yeah.
This is true. Yeah. Yeah, it's dead.
It'd be worse if it was a live bird, you know.
That it would be harder to do that while eating a candy bar.
I agree.
You'd have to be, I would imagine you need both hands to do that.
That would demonstrate a great deal of skill.
Yeah. So after she cuts off the head, she looks around to see if anybody's watching her or saw her. And there's an old lady across the street just waving at her, all happy that she's there.
Oh, yeah. Who was that? Was that one of the cult members?
That's what I'm assuming.
Yeah.
It's one of the cult members. Sense. Just like the creepy guy at the funeral earlier who was just smiling at her.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah, that seems to be their signature. They're all smiling all the time.
Super happy.
Yeah.
They must be doing something right.
I mean, you meant maybe we should all switch religions.
No, I'm good. So back at home, we are down the hall from Annie when she thinks she hears Steve yell hello. Annie responds, but she doesn't get a response back. So she heads up and she notices that her mom, Ellen, that just passed away, her room is wide open. So she walks downstairs and asks Steve if he opened it, and he says he didn't, but we cut to him locking the door and Annie apologizing, saying it's ridiculous, but he says, no, it's fine. It's not silly. I don't mind. I'll lock the door. We don't need to go in there. And then we get the phone call that is from the funeral home to let us know that Ellen's grave has been desecrated, but he doesn't want to tell Annie. He doesn't want her to worry any, so he just said that it had to do with some billing crap. And then Annie tells Steve that she's going to the movies,
which is not true.
Right. She ends up attending a bereavement group. Annie reveals that she used to do them as she was a child, and she felt like they sort of helped.
I wonder if there's something to be said about the fact that both of them lie to each other in that scene.
Yeah, I worry about how good their marriage actually is.
I mean, I feel like they did kind of imply later on that they're not doing too well, that their marriage was already on the ropes when all this kind of happened.
Sure.
And you can see it right there in the fact that he lies to her and she lies right back to him, right? It means something.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I feel like his lie to her was trying to protect her from the, like, dealing with the, hey, your mom that we just buried desecrated. I don't know if maybe her lie to him was also trying to protect him to be like, look, I'm hurting, but I don't want you to worry that I'm hurting. So I'm going to go to the support group, but I don't want you to think I'm going to the support group.
I felt it just showed kind of a mutual lack of trust in general.
That is definitely a way to look at it.
He didn't trust her to be able to handle that information and to be able to, you know, to be able to sort of, I guess, cling to him, I guess, if she was needed his support or strength or whatever.
Sure.
He didn't, and she didn't trust him to understand what she was dealing with. And I don't know. That was my feeling anyway.
I think you're right. Yeah. It definitely reads as a not great marriage.
Yeah.
I didn't, you know, feel like that they had. I
mean, you can tell it's not a great marriage from the camera work and the lighting and the music, right?
I mean. Yeah, I mean, it gives us that impression. It makes it feel that way.
That's how you know when your marriage is on the rocks, when all the lighting starts to get dark and bluey. And yeah, just that's a big sign right there.
That's pretty funny. All right. Okay. So at the support group, she tells her that, you know, she had lost her mother, but her mother was old and she wasn't altogether there at the end, and that they were estranged for a while, which didn't make it easy. When she was a baby, her father died from starvation because he had psychotic depression and he starved himself. When she was younger, her brother at the age of 16 hung himself and blamed their mom, Ellen, for trying to stick people inside of him in his suicide note.
Well, that was probably true.
It's like at first you're like, what? But yes, you're right. it's probably true. That, which to me, because the first time looking at it, I'm like, well, if you didn't have, I remember thinking this, why stick Payman in you if you didn't have a host for it yet? But her original plan was her own son. And yeah. So she stuck with Payman in her for decades, waiting to get him to a new host.
Well, that's another question. Like, what if Payman is in her? That doesn't mean that Payman is her. Like, how does that work? Are they both in control of the body? What's going on there?
For the grandma, to me, it felt like a symbiotic relationship.
Hmm.
Like, we get to share this body. But it didn't feel that way for Charlie. I mean, I couldn't tell because...
Well, you can't tell because Charlie's weird anyway.
She is weird anyway.
I'm leaning more toward what you said before, that it's like, it's a big, big wad of souls altogether, that it's not just...
Sure.
It's not just Payman. It's a whole wad.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But yeah, well, thank you for siding with me.
Yeah, you're winning me over here.
Okay. She says that she finally let her mother back in the relationship when Charlie was born. She didn't let her back in her life when Peter was born, because maybe something inside of her was like, hey, don't let her around my son. But when Charlie was around, she let the mother come back to, yeah, I guess, help raise the child. And she really latched onto Charlie.
What do you think happened to the father, the one who, this psychotic depression? What is the truth behind that?
Oh, I don't know, because, I mean, unless she was trying to stick it in him first and he killed himself so that he couldn't do it, I didn't read that far backwards. In this scene, we learn a lot about her past and how horrible her life has been and all the loss she's dealt with. But what I noticed on second viewing is that Joan is sitting here in that support group. Joan, who's the friend of Ellen, her mother, who pretends to be her friend later, is in the circle in the support group sitting there. So she does get to hear all this information.
She must have known. How did she know that she was going to go there?
I felt like the cult or coven, whatever you want to call them, had a lot more information than anybody should.
Okay.
Like, we're going to get to this pole, like this electric pole or whatever that is really important here.
Oh,
how,
yeah,
did they know that Peter was going to be driving with Charlie in the car?
That's
near this pole.
True.
Now, we do know that there's a symbol on that pole that's the symbol of this coven, or it's the symbol of Payman.
Right, yeah.
That does influence events, but how would they have known? They seem to have a lot more knowledge than seems likely.
That's interesting, yeah. Something supernatural is going on there.
Mm-hmm. So then we see Charlie at home. She's clucking again, building her toys. We see the light pass through her room, and then she goes outside to try to find the grandma. Like, she's on her way to do this. Meanwhile, Annie gets an email about her progress in her work. The email says something like, we promise we won't judge. We just want to know where you're at in your miniatures. This is where Peter comes in, asks if he can borrow one of the cars to go to a party. She said, there's no drinking, right? And he has this smart aleck response of, well, I'm not old enough to drink. And she goes, well, that's a bullshit answer.
Yeah, really.
Like, are you going to drink or not? He goes, well, I said no. Which he didn't, but now he's saying that he said no. Either way, we know he's going to get high.
And either way, it also seems like that it seems a little lax on her part. Like, clearly she's got other things on her mind.
Sure.
And she hassles him a little about it, but ultimately it just seems like she kind of gives up, right? She's just like, you're gonna do whatever you're gonna do, is the feeling.
Yes,
I
but
got.
Then she tries to make sure he can't drink by forcing him to take her sister.
Yeah, I guess that was the reason for that.
His, yeah, sister. Yeah.
And surprisingly, he does.
He does, even though she doesn't want to go, but there's a scene. So she runs outside, finds Charlie walking barefoot towards what we as the audience see, Charlie walking to her grandmother, even though her grandmother's not alive. It's like the spirit of her or something. This is when the blue light happens. She's out there. So I think at somewhere right around here is where Payman goes into Charlie. She goes, she gets after her for going out barefoot, and she tells her, you're going to a party with your brother. Charlie's like, what party? And she goes, it's a school thing. You just go. It's good. It'll be good to be around people. But she doesn't want to go. Peter doesn't want to take her, but the mom puts her foot down and makes them both go to this party.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, on the way to the party, we see them pass this telephone pole, and we zoom in on it like for way too long, so we know it's important.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that.
It's got the cult symbol or the coven symbol on it.
Yeah.
And so we know that this is going to come into play. Now, at first viewing, I didn't notice, even though it zooms in for way too long.
Right, yeah.
It was second viewing when I knew what was going to happen that I was like, oh, okay. It makes sense. When we're at the party, Peter sees that girl, Bridget. He goes to speak with her and ask her how the party is.
Yeah.
And she's like, why do you want to decide if you're going to come or not? And he's like, yeah, is it good? Should I come? And she goes, either way, which is a little awkward. But then he wins her over by asking if she smokes weed because he brought a lot of weed.
There's so many apathetic characters in this movie. Like,
Yeah.
There's so much apathy. You could fill a bucket with it.
Yeah. So she apparently wants to smoke weed. Charlie wants to go with him. He asks Charlie to stay behind. She doesn't want to because she doesn't know anybody at the party, which I completely can relate to. And then he says, hey, they have cake over there. And she's like, it's not meant for me. He's like, it's for everybody. It's a party. Just go tell them you want cake. But we had already saw them chopping walnuts with a big old knife when they were making the cake just a little bit earlier. So we know that this is going to be a problem.
But also, if you're right, that by this point, she's got payment in her, right?
Mm-hmm.
Potentially everything she's doing here now has an agenda.
Yeah, at least from payment's point of view.
I was wondering why she would eat an unknown food when she knows she has that allergy. And at the time, I was chalking it up in my head to, oh, she's got to be like somehow mentally handicapped or something. Like she doesn't know what she's doing. But now, I don't know if she was or not, but I mean, Payman clearly has this agenda that he knows that he needs her to get that allergic reaction in order for this plan to come to fruition.
Yeah, right. And I can be behind that it almost feels like he's a subtle nudge in her brain right now. Eat the cake. Like maybe he hasn't latched in enough.
Sure.
He's just brand new there. Got there that day.
Right.
Maybe. So when Peter goes to this other room, he assumes that him and Bridget are going alone. And then when he gets there's a lot of other people there.
Yeah.
And so he's sharing his, bong with everybody, just, smoking. We see Charlie start to have trouble breathing. She drinks a glass of water. She's wheezing. She finally goes to get Peter to tell him. And at least Peter at this time, he wasn't being a great brother beforehand, but he drops everything to try to rush her to the hospital the moment that he realizes, oh crap, my sister's having trouble breathing. Why the mother didn't make them take the EpiPen?
Yeah, that is very strange. You would think it would be like glued to her, right?
Yeah.
You would like duct tape it to her face or something.
So Peter starts driving. He's very panicked. He's speeding really to the hospital, trying to go as fast as he can. Charlie's getting worse and worse in the back seat. She's kicking around. She can't breathe. She's laying down. She eventually opens the window, stick her head out the window. At that moment, Peter sees a deer dead on the road. Swerves out of the way of the deer,
which must have been planted there
completely, and then gets way too close to that telephone pole, and then we hear this pop, this like,
well, also the fact that we see Charlie like stick her neck out right out the side of the window, which it's debatable, like you say, like she's having an allergic reaction, like she's trying to get more air was the initial thing they make you think, right?
Yeah.
But like, I'm not sure that's what that was, right?
Because
it could well have just been, okay, time to put this plan into motion.
So I remember watching this. I was definitely watching it by myself. And this moment happened. I was, I'm sitting in my dark office just watching this. And I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Like, Peter stops the car. He's panicked. I'm panicked. Yeah, and I'm just watching the movie.
And so was I, right? Yeah. When I watched it too.
He gets to mutter, you okay? Like really quietly. Like he's in shock.
Like,
he wants to check.
even saying that is ridiculous because he knows what just happened.
He does. He doesn't want to admit it to himself. He never turns around to look.
It's the longest scene with him just sitting there staring at the camera, and we know what happened. He knows what happened. They've built up the characters enough that, he doesn't want it to be real. We don't want it to be real either, right? Because there's so much gone wrong in this family already. You're just like, it's got to be a mistake, right? Somehow everything's got to be fine, right? Like, it's just...
I was flabbergasted. At this point of the movie, like, what just happened?
Yeah.
I did not see it coming.
Me neither.
Advertisements for this movie made Charlie seem like a predominant character throughout the whole movie.
Excellent.
So they did a really good job in marketing to shock everybody.
They were the anti-cube, the opposite of the cube ads.
Oh, yeah. No lie. Cube, it ruined the whole thing.
Every single detail.
We haven't been moving, the rooms have.
Yeah.
That trailer was
bad. And now you also just spoiled it for anyone.
I'll put a warning at the beginning. All right. So he finally starts the car, drives all the way home, parks it in front of the house. We see him go in the house. We see him lay down on the bed, and it transitions to morning, and his eyes have not even blinked. Like, it's supposed to show time passing. He's still just laying there. We hear Annie in the background saying that she's going to go run an errand. And when she gets outside, she just screams like crazy. We cut to her screaming in the room, saying she wants to die. She can't handle it. And Steve's trying to console her. And then we cut to a scene of Charlie's head on the side of the road, covered with ants like crazy.
Yeah, that is a wonderful shock scene.
It is. It completely. Oh, man. Then we transition transition to the funeral. They're lowering the casket. We're still hearing the same screaming from the moment she walked out of that car all the way to the funeral. It's still the same crying scream. It's like, while the scenes aren't one take, that scream is like a voiceover one take of her crying and wailing and screaming, and it doesn't stop. It's so uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And it's also, it feels right, right? Because, like, I mean, it's there's a lot of movies, I think, where somebody dies and there's a reaction, but it feels like not
genuine.
Yeah, like you don't feel that someone's soul is torn apart feeling that I think is really more realistic, right, for what happens. And in this one, they absolutely do. You absolutely get that like a realistic, I feel like more realistic reaction of someone who's just lost a child and can't believe it and can't handle it.
Yeah. At the meeting after the funeral where they're hosting guests at their house, Annie is in her bedroom lying down and Steve is the actually only one hosting the guests. Not a word is said in this scene at all, but we see as Annie's laying in her bed that another word is written on her wall, which is spelled Z-A-Z-A-S.
Mm-hmm.
Just another weird word. Then we see that Peter, from his point of view, can see right into the treehouse that's creepy. The red lights are on, and we know that Annie's spending time out in that treehouse. The next day, Peter's in school, and he's imagining seeing himself in the mirror, and he is smiling at himself when he himself is not smiling. It's kind of creepy.
Does that mean that Payman is in him now?
I don't think so, but I think it's somehow trying to wear him down, because it's like he has to weaken his host. So maybe he's getting more powerful as he passes on, or the coven's casting some kind of spell on him, but it's like...
So why do you not think so? Let me ask you that.
Because the light didn't pass him yet, and we know that it goes into Annie before him.
Oh, true. Okay, that's right. Got it.
Right. So I think after Charlie died, it's looking for the next host. So maybe it has some kind of power as it's roaming, because I don't think it gets into Annie until Steve dies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think we see the moment it happens.
I think you're right.
During lunch again, Peter's smoking weed under the bleachers with his friends, but he starts to cry, hold his chest, saying that he can't breathe, which he's just trying to relate to the loss. I don't think Charlie's in him or Payman's in him yet.
I agree. Yeah. I just remembered I wrote down a bunch of notes. Were any of them for this movie? No, none of them were, of course. Never mind.
No, you have a lot of good comments so far. Don't you worry. We've been doing great.
I mean, this was a movie that was like, it definitely had me, as you know, because you were sitting right there, right? It definitely had me pretty locked in from beginning to end, even if I was frantically fiddling with a Rubik's Cube to burn nervous energy the whole time.
That's funny. I was like, it's making too much noise. Stop the room. It's going to pay attention to the movie.
I was paying attention. I really was. I was very dialed into the movie the whole time.
Then we have a small scene where Peter rides home on his bike. He's afraid to go inside. And when he finally does, we notice that Annie is in the car. I guess she was waiting for Peter to get home before she drives off. She drives back to the support group. She doesn't want to go inside. And then Joan jumps out and flags her down. Joan is very pushy here. Annie clearly doesn't want to go in the support group, but she gives her phone number, tells her that this support group has helped her a lot because she lost her son and her grandson. They both drowned in the same time. And the little one was 7. And so Annie feels really bad for Joan. And she gives her number just in case. She tells her, like, just take this in case. But she never goes inside the support group again.
God, they have us going for so long. Like...
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, because the remark about she wanted to put person in me or whatever, like you mentioned earlier, how have I not learned yet in horror movies that if you have a crazy character say something crazy, it's the truth, right? How have I not learned that yet?
Sure. we have a little bit more of a scene establishing that Annie no longer wants to sleep in the same bed as Steve. She wants to be out in the treehouse because she has a more connection. Steve's just worried that it's super cold out there and the heaters aren't enough, and he agrees to it, but Annie seems to be annoyed, like, is it okay? And he's like, yeah, just please come in if you get too cold. It just feels like whatever relationship they had has deteriorated even more. We have a small little scene where we see that the mail is getting stuffed into the mailbox, like no one's checking their mail, and there's a pamphlet that comes in that's calling all skeptics. It's for like seances. So I think this was like the first attempt to try to get Annie to come view a seance.
Right, and that did not go anywhere.
Right. We know we have more scenes of Annie working on the projects, getting called from work, asking how it's going. So she's painting. She happens to spill a paint, but I swear she didn't touch it, and some force just knocked over the blue paint. I don't think she hit the table. She was grabbing a different paint, and this blue thing just, it was like a gust of wind, knocked over this blue paint.
Yeah.
And the blue paint gets onto the note with Joan's phone number on it. So it reminds her, like, oh, you know what? I can talk to Joan. I'm gonna call Joan.
Yeah.
So we cut to her walking to Joan's house. The important thing that really happens here is that she has a welcome mat in the front of her door that says Joan. Annie comments that her mother used to make ones exactly like this.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is interesting.
Man, they gave us clues for every single thing.
Yeah. We get here that Annie says that her relationship with her kids have not been great ever since she sleptwalked, poured paint thinner on both of them and herself, and was holding a match that was not lit. She woke up when the match was struck, which means she blew it out before it can light them all on fire, and her own children hadn't trusted her after that point.
That's interesting, because that can't have been payment, so it has to have been like...
It could have been her subconscious trying to destroy everybody that could have been a host for payment.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it was like her way of like, like subconsciously, just like, well, I'll put it into this before it happens to us.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, I guess that's making me think maybe the medium thing is real. Like maybe, yeah. maybe them having... So payment doesn't ever go into the dad, right?
No.
It only goes into members of the family, direct descendants of bloodline. The grandmother.
Yeah.
So like maybe you have to be actually a medium.
Which would make me think that the Annie's dad was never, Payman was never
right.
a target for him.
Sure.
And he really did just kill himself because he was depressed.
Or.
Because he was married to a crazy woman.
Well, yeah. I mean, it makes sense if yeah. I mean, considering how all the shit we know that she was into, like. I guess it just makes sense that she drove him insane.
Sure.
Or even murdered him because she didn't want him to interfere with her plans.
That is something I didn't think about.
Like maybe she just needed his sperm, you know?
Yeah.
And then she was done with him.
That could be it. Yeah, wow. And then Annie would have been the backup plan, though, because her brother was an older brother. He would have been the first plan for payment, and Annie would have been a backup plan. She needed to have children. Yeah, that's crazy. We have a moment where Steve goes into Annie's workroom, and she sees that she has made a diorama of the telephone pole and the station wagon and the head of Charlie's death. And Steve gets really mad about
it. I mean, that it was very strange. Yes.
It was. She's saying it's an objective viewpoint to help her get over it. But if I was Peter, I'd freak out seeing that.
I think anyone would.
Yeah. So Steve's obviously mad about it. He says, he asks her if she's going to come down for dinner. And she goes, I'm going to cook dinner. And he goes, I already cooked dinner. I don't care if you come down to eat or not, but we're going to eat. So then we get this dinner scene, which is maybe the most intense scene of the movie. I don't know. Maybe second most.
There are a lot of intense scenes.
You're right. I don't know why I said that. So they're all eating. Peter gives Steve a compliment saying that the dinner is good, which seems to set Annie off. She's like, ugh. And Peter's like, Mom, if you have something to say, say it. And she's like, what? I don't have anything to say. He's like, just say it. She goes, I don't like the way you're always sneering at me. And he's like, I don't sneer at you. She's like, you don't have to with that face of yours. I'm like,
what the heck?
You know, like, she freaks out. She's saying that she knows what he did. She knows he knows what he did. But if he doesn't admit what he did, she can't forgive him for it. Because no one in this house will admit to what they did. And I'm screaming at the TV, including you, because she doesn't want to admit that she has a fault in this. But this is where Peter speaks up for himself. Peter goes, what about you, Mom? She didn't want to go to the party, so why was she there?
Right.
And I was like, yes, Peter, you're right.
Yeah.
Steve stops the argument. Annie leaves. She's pissed off. It was a very intense, hard to watch scene.
And yet also another one of those scenes that I feel like is kind of realistic, right? Like there's sort of this idea people have, you know, after a trauma, people will vent their feelings or whatever, but then they'll become closer in the end, you know, after, and this is kind of a,
sure.
No, no, oh. they hate each other. They're like, this is the tension is just worsening and already bad.
I felt bad for Steve, who was really trying to hold them together.
Yeah, me too.
He's trying so hard to hold them together.
And he's got nothing to do with this, except that he married into this crazy family.
He married into the crazy family. Yeah, unfortunately. We get more of Annie working on miniature. She gets a call from the people about her on the preschool. She breaks a chair because she's so mad, like it's, you know, a little miniature chair. She realizes she needs more supplies, so she goes out to get supplies. And while she's at the hobby store, she runs into Joan. But Joan doesn't flag her down. She just sees Joan packing some supplies into her SUV, and she runs over and she's like, Joan? And she's like, Annie, I'm so glad I saw you. I want you to know. I'm so happy. Something really ridiculously amazing happened to me, and I have to share with you. And Annie's kind of freaking out, like, what's going on? And she starts telling her.
She's very animated about it. Like, she looks way too happy.
Yeah. And Annie is a little like off-putted by this. And she tells her about a seance, and she kind of laughs it off. She's like, no, I get it. I thought it was stupid too. I got invited. They said they were welcoming all skeptics. And I saw a guy do some crazy stuff there. There was scientists that are non-believers that at the end of this were believing stuff that had happened. And it made me want to speak to the guy afterwards. And he did it. He called my grandson to me, and I got to talk to my grandson. And if you're not doing anything, I want to show you. It's so amazing. I have to share. And Annie's like freaked out, doesn't want anything to do with it, but somehow agrees and ends up in her apartment. And they're there on this table. They have candles on the table, and she has the seance. They light the candle, and they tell her, Joan tells her grandson to move an object. If you hear me, move an object to the right if it means yes, and to the left if it means no. The spirit does. There's a very comical scene where Annie like looks under the table to try to look for anything magnetic.
Well, I mean, that's what you would do, right?
Yeah, completely. Absolutely. Like, all right, where's the trick?
Right,
Who's pulling the cards? Where's the magic buttons or whatever? She's doing it. She's getting answers. Joan is talking to her grandkid, and Annie makes her stop. She's like, stop. I can't do this anymore. Joan's like, why? And Joan tells her grandchild, I'll be back. Like, don't go anywhere. I'll be back. Annie wants to leave, so she gives Annie the candle and this instructions in a language that she doesn't know what it is. But if you just read this out loud, light this candle, make sure everybody in your house is in the house when you do it. Those are the rules. Mm. I don't know what the language is. Just read it. It works. I'm like, oh my gosh, why would you read a language?
It's interesting. I don't remember whether it was that incantation or the one at the very end of the movie when they're celebrating payment, right? But I remember that at least one of these incantations contained the words that we've been seeing written all around the house.
Oh, I think that was at the end.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Because we don't see her read it. We see after the fact when she's waking the family up. But real quick, before we get there, on the way driving home from Joan, she's a little freaked out, and then we hear the of a tongue in the back of the car, and she jumps. I jumped
as well.
We were like, what is going on?
Yeah, it's so creepy. I love that.
So she gets home and it's night. She wakes up Peter. She tells him, like, I'm sorry for everything I did. She wakes up Steve, asks him to get downstairs. She tells him that she talked to Charlie, and Steve thinks she's crazy. Peter's freaking out, but is willing to do it. It seems like he's trying to trust his mom, try to have a good relationship with his mom. They light the candle. They bring out Charlie's sketchbook. It's not seeming to work. Eventually it does. Steve does the same thing that she did, looks under the table for some kind of trick. Yeah. After getting really upset, all of a sudden Charlie starts talking through her, like if her mediumness or her ability to conjure the spirit let Charlie speak to her to the rest of the family. And Charlie's like, Mom, where are you? What's going on?
And in Charlie's voice too.
Yes.
Yeah, which is the other
freaking creepy
thing.
Steve, to make it stop, blows out the candle and throws water on Annie. And she's like, what the F? What'd you do that for? And she looks at Peter, who's like, completely sobbing, freaking out.
Yeah.
And she's like, what happened? It was another intense scene.
Yeah. And you got to wonder, kind of like a lot of the movie, you got to wonder what the intent of that was, right? What the point of her doing that was. Does that make payment stronger? Does that help pave the way for his entrance into the members of the family? Does it, you know, what does it do? Who knows?
Yeah. The next day, Peter's at class. We see the light finally pass by Peter that we saw earlier. Steve gets a call that Peter is starting to be frantic, that some vengeful spirit is after him. And he calls Annie to tell her, like, it's your fault. Like, now your son's freaking out at school, and I had to go pick him up. And she gets mad. He hangs up on her.
And this is another kind of strange thing. Like, does the father? I hate whenever they do the thing where someone sees obvious supernatural events that can't possibly be explained, and that they're still not believing it at all. And I can't tell whether that's the case here or whether he does recognize what it is, but he's just totally against it. And like, you yeah, know.
It's hard in this case. I see that trope all the time in horror movies. You're right. Spoilers for Insidious.
Yeah.
But I felt like the husband in there went out of the way to not believe for so long.
And that is part of why I am saying this, because I am very influenced by having recently watched that movie and been very frustrated about that. So we'll have to get to that when we talk about that.
Sure. But I think Steve was trying to be a good father here and trying to keep a rational head on his shoulders. I don't think it's in his mind to think supernatural is real.
Yeah, but...
But he saw some he stuff happen. He just saw it.
Like, what do you...
Yeah, he did.
I mean, if he didn't believe it was real, why did he think blowing out the candle would fix it, right? You know, like, yeah. Come on. I mean...
So we have a couple weird scenes. There's one scene where Annie wakes up. She sees a trail of ants. She follows it to Peter's room, and she sees ants all over his head. She is there freaking out.
But she doesn't get the ants off his head.
She doesn't get the ants off his head.
Which is kind of strange. It's not the normal reaction to that.
But when he wakes up, he's like, Mom, what are you doing? She's like, huh? She just starts spitting out all these like truths that are too hard to hear. Like, I never wanted to be your mother. And he goes, what do you mean? Yeah. He's like, I tried to have you aborted. He's like, how? Like, every way I could. Anything they told me not to do, I did it. Everything that I wasn't supposed to do. But I'm glad it didn't work. I'm glad you're here. And he's like, you wanted to kill me? And he starts crying. And then she wakes up. And that was a dream as well.
And that's really telling as well, right? Because like, she wanted him, she didn't want to have a male baby, again, because of, I guess, her subconscious medium power knowledge of what was going on. But then at the same time, he was protected from her attempts to abort him, which is very interesting.
We have a scene where Annie is in a room and she hears what sounds like scratchings down the hall. And when she gets to Charlie's room, she sees that the notebook that she drew in is being drawn in a lot. And some of those are pictures of Peter and his eyes are like crossed out. We have Peter lying in his bed. He hears a click. It's very dark, and we look, and it obviously looks like Charlie standing in his room, even though it's super dark. And then her head falls off, but when it hits the floor, it's a ball. We hear it hit the floor, and we see it rolling at him. It's just a little weird.
It's more than just a little weird. It's kind of terrifying, actually.
You're right. It definitely was terrifying. Then we get a dream sequence where Peter's convinced that Annie's trying to yank his head off, but where the arms are coming from, there's a wall there, so no human could possibly be standing behind the head of the bed trying to yank that way.
Yeah.
But when Annie wakes him up, he's convinced that she was trying to rip his head off. She begs him not to share that information. Like, don't tell your father this. This is not true. I love you. I would never try to rip your head off. this is crazy.
That's the title for this episode. I love you. I would never try to rip your head off. No, maybe not.
The next day, well, it's just I got to make a graphic for that whole thing. And I feel like if it's too many just, words. Yeah, it's funny though, but it'd be like, I would never try to rip your head off. I don't know. Like, how do we shorten it? I don't know. I'll listen to it. I'll figure it out later. The next day, Annie tries to see Joan again, but Joan isn't there. But we get to see the inside of the apartment. And inside the apartment, there's a lot of candles everywhere. The symbol of the coven is in different places in her apartment.
Wait, hang on. This is Joan's apartment?
Joan's apartment. So she's banging outside. She's banging outside. She's trying to go to see Joan to try to stop whatever's happening.
Oh, right. Now I remember. Okay. Yeah.
Sure. Got it. So it's crazy. When she's walking up to the apartment, the camera's like upside down, or it does this weird like motion sickness, like panning around so we can see her upright, but it spins in like 180 degrees. It's very nauseous. But inside the apartment, we see her kitchen table has a pentagram on it. There's a picture of Peter there, and there are what looks like the ceremony from the end of the movie in the figures. We have figures that Charlie has made that are on in the back. And then we have three severed heads of different animals in the more front row. And then a model that would be Charlie supposedly in the front of this thing. It's like the whole setup of the ceremony. You kind of have to pause it.
I was about to say, really I don't think I noticed all that. That's interesting. This movie has a lot of detail.
It was a lot of little details there. Then we get Peter at school and Joan is across the street trying to expel his spirit. She's saying some of those words like xanity and danity, and she's like, Peter, I expel you, Peter, I expel you, stuff like that, trying to get his spirit to leave his own body. And he goes home. She's digging through all the welcome mats and seeing that they are exactly like the one she made, except for the one that is for Charlie has that coven symbol on the corners, which is really interesting. And she reads into these books. She sees the name Payman, God of Mischief, and there's a line about the riches that will become become those who summon him. And then she sees pictures of her mom standing next to Joan, and Joan and her mom are really good friends. They're all wearing the necklace throughout the pictures, the necklace with the coven symbol on it. Mm-hmm. And there's a picture with her mom, Ellen, being showered with like gold by all the members of the coven.
I also think it's strange that they refer to him as King of Hell. I'm like, isn't Lucifer supposed to be King of Hell? Who is
this person? They say one of the top eight kings of Hell.
Oh, they do? Okay.
So I think he's number eight. like who says top eight?
I wonder if this is a real character in some demonology historically.
I would say that most American horror movies do base their characters on demons in history, that other forms of literature.
Well, that's why I'm looking it up.
I get you. One, like Insidious, though, does not. All of the things in Insidious are made up for their own. Okay, read what you found.
Not only is this a real historical spirit name, but the symbol is his actual historical symbol.
Wow.
The symbol from the movie is the actual sigil of Paimon, historically.
That's crazy.
That was used in all these demonologies. Wow. That's freaking cool. The Wikipedia page has a whole list of different historical grimoires that mention Paimon and have his sigil and stuff like that. Cool. That's interesting. I learned something today.
Yeah, it is definitely interesting. We have a scene where Steve's at work and he's writing to a doctor worried about Annie's potential mental breakdown. And this is where he receives images of Ellen's grave and how the grave has been excavated. And the email itself is all about the insurance claim around the events, because apparently they had some insurance on it. Annie finally goes in the attic. There's been this smell. Steve mentioned it earlier. But she goes in the attic. When she opens it, there's a ton of flies everywhere. And she finds a decapitated body, and the dress that she's wearing has all the runes all over it, Paimon's runes, and there's a rune above where the body sits on the ceiling of the attic. We're in Peter's class. There's a lot of clucking. He keeps like looking back and forth to try to find where this clucking's coming from.
Yeah, it's really torturing him now.
Oh, yeah. It looks like he raises his head like he has a comment, but when you look at his face, it looks like he's having a stroke. It's like one side doesn't match the other and it's drooping.
I don't know if I noticed that.
It's kind of like this. And then his face is like falling on this side.
I don't think the microphone can see you very well, but I don't think I noticed that. Did I notice that? I don't remember anymore.
Oh, you're saying the listeners can't see me. Yeah. I get what you're saying. I was like, what? I'm like, but I'm talking to you too. You're right. But then he slams his head into the desk twice. And then the second one breaks his nose and he starts freaking out, screaming. But it seems to snap him out of whatever was controlling him.
Yeah. That is interesting. Clearly, there is a way to control people that doesn't involve inhabiting them. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Interesting behind the scenes stuff is that the actor wanted to really break his nose for the scene, and the director was like, absolutely not.
Yeah, no kidding.
There's no way. So unbeknownst to him, they replaced the desk with a foam desk, but they underestimated his willingness to do the scene.
Oh, wow.
And so in doing it, he hurt his jaw. He like dislocated his jaw.
Jesus Christ.
Slammed his head into the...
Okay, that actor is crazy.
He's a little crazy.
That's insane.
It's a little too method for me.
Yeah, that's... I'll be expecting him to be involved in some very strange and brutal celebrity death in another 10 years or something.
Well, we'll follow his career. We're going to watch Old eventually.
Yeah.
The stool tries to contact Annie first, but when she doesn't answer, they call Steve. Steve is driving home. He's really distracted. He almost runs a red light. He slams on the brakes before it's too late, and Steve just breaks down crying like he's at his wit's end. Peter's in the back sleeping. It's just like really sad. I feel really bad for Steve.
All that emotional damage is wasted since he can't be inhabited by the spirit because he doesn't have the genes.
It's just a side effect, sure. Once at home, Annie doesn't understand what happened. Annie's trying to explain what she discovered. And Steve is just over it. He doesn't want to hear anything about it. He's telling her, like, look, your son is hurt. But Steve finally listens when she tells him, just go up to the attic. You have to trust me. Go up to the attic. There's a body up there. He goes up there. He finds the body. And he blames her for the whole thing. He's like, all these times you said you were going to the movies, you were digging up your mother's grave, you cut her head off, you're messed up, we need to get you help.
It's clear that I think he's in a level of denial that I have to say I think is unrealistic. I don't think you could be that in denial after the stuff that he's seen.
Sure. I mean, sometimes though, that I think he believes the easiest explanation is his wife, who has a history of mental illness in her family, is the cause. But
he's seen things.
He has seen things
are not consistent with that hypothesis.
One thing on your part of that argument, I will definitely cite on. He saw that the grave was excavated.
Yeah.
I've carried a casket at a funeral. it takes six adult men to do it easily, yeah, I feel like.
No kidding.
And there's no way that his wife pulled up that casket on its own.
Right.
Stole the body and moved it into their attic.
Yeah, it's the whole thing is ridiculous on so many levels.
Yeah. Yeah. She tells Steve that, look, I have this book. I tried to burn it earlier. I think this will stop it. I tried to burn it, but then I caught on fire. So if you will burn this book for me, we could put an end to this. But I know it'll kill me. I'm okay with dying, but I need you to burn this book for me. And this is Charlie's drawing book.
Yeah.
He says...
And at that point, they really have us believing that this is all just some seance gone wrong.
Yeah.
You know? And they totally have us believing that, and that all we need to do is banish the spirit back and everything will be back to normal. And oh God, what a load of crap.
Yeah, completely. So I was like really invested here. Like Steve says he's not going to do it. He's over it. He needs to get her help. So she grabs the book. She throws it into the fire. I'm like, wow, she did it. But instead of her combusting into flames, Steve combusts into flames.
Which is brilliant because it's such a more effective punishment almost to her for doing that, right?
And then we see this moment in her face. Her face just loses it. She gives up on everything. And I think this is the moment that payment got inside of her.
What, did we see the flash right then? Or
we did not. But we saw the light was going around that he was free.
Yeah.
The clucking has been around her. I think it's been trying.
I'm just wondering whether it was that moment. I mean, certainly that moment that he took over her.
Yeah.
But I don't know for sure that she wasn't inhabited earlier than that.
Yeah, I don't know either.
It's debatable, right?
I agree with you. That's true. Then we cut to Peter waking up after dark. It's extremely dark, and Annie is up on the wall and the ceiling, kind of like she's Spider-Woman, but it's hard to tell. You have to really focus.
Yeah.
Your eyes have to adjust to this dark.
Yeah, you made me put away the Rubik's Cube.
Yeah, I was like, you have to look. You have to look. And you see her crawling across the ceiling. Peter doesn't see her. She's crawling in silence. Peter goes downstairs. We see a broken piano. It's in pieces. And then Peter finds Steve's burnt body there on the ground. Outside in the windows, if you look closely, there are members of the coven there. They're all smiling.
And we see some inside the house too.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, and they're just naked, but like freakishly happy.
Yeah.
And also the way it's, something about the way it's lit and whatever, they're kind of inconspicuous in a strange, I don't know how else to say it. Like,
they, you can almost not notice them.
You can almost not notice them. They look like elements of the background.
Yeah.
Like the way they're lit, they're just kind of this faded gray that's part of the background while the main characters pop. You know, it's very, very odd. Very odd.
Still crawling on the ceiling, Annie is coming after Peter. Peter runs upstairs to the attic. He closes the door, and we hear this banging that doesn't sound natural. Like, how could she be banging like that? Then we cut to her. She's attached to the ceiling, again, like Spider-Woman.
Yes.
Banging her head against the door of it, trying to get in.
It's wonderful. And it's one of those corny kind of horror movie trope kind of looking scenes, but it's very fitting, I think, for how things have escalated. Like, everything has been getting crazier and crazier, and okay, now we're at full horror movie Spider Woman banging her head against the door.
As Peter notices the body and the symbols and the naked cult members, all of a sudden Annie's in the room with him on the ceiling, kind of floating up there. She has a piano wire wrapped around her neck and she's pulling it back and forth to like make a sawing motion to try to snap her head off. Peter freaks out, jumps out the window, hits the ground, and we hear the thud of her finishing cutting her head. And we hear it hit the floor. We don't see it. And then we see the light pass by.
Yeah. And I gotta say, like, how did they know that wouldn't kill him, right? I don't know. But I guess they know a lot of things, so.
Sure. Now Peter's displaying Charlie's mannerisms. Annie's floating body goes into the treehouse. Peter follows to the treehouse. There's all these members of the coven bowing down. Charlie's up there. On the front is her head on this mannequin with a crown on top of it. And Joan gets up, removes the crown, places it on Peter's head, addresses him as Charlie, then proclaims that Charlie is now Payman, and they've corrected his female body and given him his preferred male host. And the coven all hails Peter as King Payman.
And it's a lovely scene. Everyone's happy. Happy ending.
I don't know that Peter's happy. He looks confused and miserable.
Why would he be unhappy? He's Payman, right? I mean,
sure.
Payman should be happy.
He's newly Payman, I guess. I don't know. He looks like he's not okay with it yet.
The ants are happy. They got all these bodies and all these heads. They're going to go bring lots of food back to the queen.
That's funny.
You know, the flies are happy. It's just everyone's still happy. Everyone's happy who's still alive.
So Toni Collette, who played Annie, told her agent that she didn't want to do any more horror movies, but he gave her the script and said, you have to do this one.
Oh, no.
It's really good. And she liked the script and she agreed to do it.
Wait, sorry. Who played which character?
Annie. The mom.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. She told them that her agent, she didn't want to do any more horror movies. You know, yeah. She's known for The Sixth Sense.
Right.
You know, But he told her that this one was a really good one and you got to do it.
I'm very impressed by the level of detail that was in this thing. I mean, they really, it's not like some cheap little horror movie that they just cranked out, you know, to please the masses. Like it felt more like a work of art that someone has put a lot of time and effort into. And I like high effort, try hard stuff myself.
Sure. So I know we talked about Alex Wolff as Peter. He, you know, a method actor, he wanted to break his nose. He made everybody on the set refer to him as Peter until the film was finished shooting.
Yeah, he's a little too method.
And afterwards, he introduced himself to the cast as if they had never met. Hi, my name's Alex. After they were done filming it.
Okay, he's insane. This dude is completely nuts.
Yeah, I just thought that was funny. Oh, man. They obviously worked simultaneously with real miniaturists to build the model of the house. And the house they built it on their own, and they built it in a way that walls could come out so they could film shots that couldn't be
from
normal.
From the other side, yeah.
Yeah, shot. And it helped also mirror the idea of the miniature, like zooming into the miniature because, oh, that wall's gone.
Yeah.
You can actually zoom into it. It's really interesting. But yeah, anything else you want to say about it?
I don't know. I guess I was thinking, although it seems like they tied off the movie really well with that nice happy ending, I think it would be interesting to see a sequel because I'm not convinced you couldn't keep going with this story. But I don't think it will. It feels like they tried too hard to tie it off. But
yeah, I don't think it needs one, but I would definitely watch it if it happens.
The main reason I was saying that is just because they've put all this effort into creating this whole world and making us interested in it. Whenever someone does that really well, I always kind of like, well, now I want to see more of it, you know?
Sure.
But yeah, you're right. I feel like they wrapped it up.
Okay, cool. All right, well, that's all I got. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, thanks for listening.